Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Gordon Fellis. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Today we visit Northport and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations for a talk by Chaz Freeman, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and former Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He'll be discussing the United States' role in the Middle East. Here with some introductory remarks is Mac DeFord, head of the Midcoast Forum.
Good afternoon and welcome to the May meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Affairs, coming to you from the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded 34 years ago now, in 1983, by a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 250, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues we discuss. For additional information, please visit our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, a retired career diplomat who currently chairs Projects International Incorporated, an organization which helps its partner enterprises and clients create business ventures across borders. Ambassador Freeman is a retired diplomat. He was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs from 1993 to 94. He has served as the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and that was during Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during the U.S. mediation of Namibian independence from South Africa and Cuban troop withdrawal from Angola. He's also served as the Deputy Chief of Mission in our embassies in both Bangkok and Beijing. And as a young Foreign Service officer fluent in Chinese, he was the interpreter for President Nixon during Nixon's historic visit to China in 1972. So let's give a very warm welcome to Ambassador Freeman. His topic today is America's continuing misadventures in the Middle East.
Thank you, Mac. Getting up here reminds me of an encounter with Linus Pauling, who, as you know, won two Nobel Prizes, one for chemistry and one for peace. Once a friend of mine asked him, when he was in his 90s, what the secret of long life was, expecting to hear something about vitamin C. Dr. Pauling replied, "Never let go of the handrail." But there is no handrail. I'm not going to talk about North Korean movies, although I spent some time when I opened the liaison office in Beijing in 1973 watching them. They were the only thing that was on Chinese television. And they're not bad, believe me. And they're better than Albanian movies, which were the alternative. Albert Einstein once shared a key insight, which undoubtedly sounds more impressive in Swiss-accented German than it does in English. He said, "Die einzige Quelle des Wissens ist die Erfahrung." The only source of knowledge is experience. And since the end of the Cold War, we've had a lot of very instructive experience in the Middle East. How much knowledge we've gained from our misadventures there is another question. So is the issue of whether we now have a government that knows what we've done before or is interested in learning from it. In the current atmosphere, slogans displace considered judgments. Intelligence about the outside world is unwelcome. Expertise is dismissed as irrelevant or worse. And policy pronouncements appease the delusions of political constituencies rather than addressing verifiable realities. The Congress has walked off the job. Tweets have superseded interagency policy studies. But just in case someone does want to know, it seems to me that our misfortunes have convincingly demonstrated at least five things. First, when people in high places twist intelligence to conform to their political convictions, unpleasant surprises and strategic setbacks are likely to follow. Second, threat assessments can be counted upon to inflate to fill the policy criteria and agendas of those whose budgets depend on them. Third, if a nation, no matter how great and powerful, acts without first asking, "And then what?" the chances are excellent that it will not like the result. There are not many problems that can be solved by the use of force alone, but there are almost none that cannot be made worse by it. And fifth, a country with no credible enemies is still vulnerable to ruin by allies and friends. In the Middle East, we found out the hard way that not every cakewalk puts a cake on your plate. It's become apparent that when they encounter reality, some of the most popular conceits of neoconservatism and New Age national security policy shrivel up and die. At least the following six neoconservative axioms have turned out to be false. First, wars in the Middle East can easily be made to pay for themselves. Second, inside every Arab, there lurks a liberal Democrat yearning to come out. Three, if you kick the enemies hard enough, they will turn into the moral equivalent of Canadians, meek, unfailingly polite to everyone, and misty-eyed about Israel. Fourth, in addition to the gerbils who inhabit there, the deserts are full of Arab moderates eager to risk their lives by bravely making war on savage Islamist fanatics. Fifth, exiles say what they mean and mean what they say. And sixth, if we sock it to terrorists over there, they won't dare follow us home. The cost of the experience that has refuted these delusions has been considerable. It starts with a lot of dead and maimed soldiers and mercenaries, as well as $6 trillion in outlays and unfunded liabilities. Some say that's now over $7 trillion. The dead and the wounded came home. The money will never return. It was poured into the sands of West Asia and North Africa, or ripped off by contractors. The fact that it was not invested in the general welfare and domestic tranquility of the United States accounts for our broken roads and rickety bridges, the educational malnutrition of our youth, and our reduced international competitiveness. But our misadventures in the Middle East have had plenty of consequences abroad, as well as here at home. These include the tribal and sectarian conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, escalating proxy wars between Saudi Arabia and Iran, a putrefied peace process between Israel, the Palestinians, and other Arabs, the gradual self-transformation of Egypt into the political equivalent of an improvised explosive device, continuing impasse with Iran, diminished respect for us and the integrity of our intelligence by allies in Europe, the ongoing metastasis of terrorism with global reach. Our homeland is shabbier, and we are less, not more secure, than we were. Terrorists explain that they're over here because we're over there. Our political leaders keep telling us they can't possibly have that right. Surely they hate us because of who we are, not what we've done and where. Really? To assert this overlooks the magnitude of our accomplishments in the Middle East. Over the first 17 years of this century alone, we have helped to engineer structural change that is unprecedented since Napoleon inaugurated the European drive to vivisect the Ottoman Empire and impose secular forms of governance in place of Islam. Our invasion of Iraq led to the reopening of the fissures Mr. Sykes and Monsieur Picot created when they sliced up Greater Syria in 1916. As a result, the states that British and French colonialism carved out of the dying Ottoman order, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, are all in various stages of actual or impending collapse. New states, based on ethnic or religious identities, have been coming into being, not just Jewish, but Kurdish, Alawite, Salafi, Shiite, Houthi. Each of these broken bits of the last 100 years' political geography has different external patrons. None is sure to survive. The kaleidoscope is still turning in the Middle East. In a region where faith defines identity, our interventions have catalyzed the transformation of religious landscape. With backing from wealthy Americans, Jewish tribalism is erasing democracy and Western values, including international Jewish values, in Israel. Political Islam, both Sunni and Shi'i, has emerged as a major threat to secularism and a source of terrorism, not just in the Middle East, but beyond it. Wars of religion comparable to the 30 years' war in Europe between Protestants and Catholics have replaced peaceful coexistence between Sunnis and Shia Arabs. Jewish colonialism and Muslim extremism have expelled or exterminated the ancient Christian communities of Palestine, Iraq, and Syria. Barring the Second Coming, the Middle East, where Christianity originated 2 millennia ago, seems likely now to remain a largely Christian-free zone. Meanwhile, as American bombs plunge down on them from aircraft and drones, Islamist terrorist movements, a localized problem as the century began, have dispersed. They now control large swaths of territory and significant populations in Afghanistan, the Levant, Libya, Nigeria, Pakistan, the Sahel, the Sinai, Somalia, and Yemen. They've also gained a significant presence among disaffected Muslims in Western Europe. Islamophobia plus blowback have begun to produce a similar presence here. Anti-Western terrorism with global reach, unheard of before 9/11, has become an obsession in both the United States and Europe. Finally, after several decades on the ropes, Russia is back in the ring in the Middle East. It's playing a skillful political military hand in Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. And whatever they think about Russia, every major security client of the United States in the region, including Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, now openly derides and seeks to hedge against America as a security partner. Iran agrees with them in their distrust of us, if not about anything else. That is one reason Tehran, somewhat surprisingly, shows very little desire to pursue a partnership or even a dialogue with Washington. Many in the region find that last point reassuring. I don't. On the evidence so far, we can't hope to deal with the violent politics in the Muslim world without Muslim allies, Muslim political partners, Shiite as well as Sunni, allowing Islamophobia and drone warfare to define our relationship with the Muslim fourth of humankind is a very large mistake. Donald Rumsfeld, the Yoda of the Pax Americana, once sagely proclaimed that the metric for success in the global war on terror was whether we were capturing, killing, deterring, or dissuading more terrorists than were being recruited and deployed against us. The answer's now in. Drone warfare and assassination don't do in terrorism. They ramp it up. Muslim rage, reprisal, and revanchism are political problems that are exacerbated rather than ameliorated by airstrikes and collateral damage. I don't know how many in this room are aware that since 1990, when the Gulf War began, this 27-year period, we have killed, directly or indirectly, 4 million Muslims. Even if you kill the leaders you are aiming at, rather than just their followers and family members, you can't decapitate a state of mind or a network. This is because drone warfare is justified by body count calculations that are even more misguided and counterproductive than they were in figuring out who was winning in Vietnam. It's because for every anti-American terrorist you kill, you get many more free. It's because the abandonment of due process in determining whose life to terminate costs you the moral high ground. It's because declaring that all Muslim males of military age are, quote, militants, unquote, who deserve to die, does not make that so. Nor does defining all those killed by drone strikes, regardless of age or gender, to have been terrorists, make their deaths any less contemptible, odious, and worthy of revenge in the eyes of those who love them. Definition duplicities of this sort vitiate any possibility of accurate evaluation of trends on the ground. The data they yield is inherently faulty, not to say fraudulent, and not at all descriptive of what is happening in the real world. Analysis based on such data can be used to provide spurious justification for the programs that generate it. It can't be used to inform and support the development of sound and effective policy. Spies must live a lie to be successful at the task of persuading others to commit treason, which is their job. To succeed, analysts must see through the lies of others and enable policymakers to do likewise. Neither spies nor analysts can afford self-deception. But self-deception is a large part of the reason that U.S. programs directed at curtailing terrorism are instead causing it to metastasize. Promiscuous military interventionism and the callous robotic murder of innocents have practical consequence. 3 years ago, a worldwide Gallup poll showed that, and I quote, "The United States was most often chosen as the greatest threat to world peace among all nations. 24% of respondents chose the U.S., far more than Pakistan, 8%, China, 6%, North Korea, Israel, and Iran, 5%. Even respondents in the United States' closest ally, the United Kingdom, found the United States to be the greatest threat in the world, ranking it on an even par with Iran at 15%. And that was in the time of no drama Obama. How many people in the Muslim world now see America as the moral wave of the future? Those of you who've been involved, some of you I understand were in the intelligence community, those of you who have been involved in the recruitment of agents know that the lack of moral appeal has a practical cost in terms of the ease, quality, and sustainability of the catch. The problems case officers have in operating under conditions of constant diarrhea while fending off kisses from bearded men with lice are real. But they are not the best explanation for our difficulties in penetrating the Islamist target. The fact is that we have a failing military and paramilitary campaign against Muslim terrorists, not a strategy, still less a winning strategy, for understanding and defeating them. We are like the man who sits down to play chess with an elaborate strategy directed at the first move only, with no follow-on. It is telling that the latest substitute for a national budget under the sequester, the so-called continuing resolution, offers the Pentagon a bonus of $2.5 billion if it could come up with a plausible strategy for defeating Daesh, the so-called Islamic Caliphate. Those who argue for more of the same must explain what we've been doing has not made things better and why they have instead become steadily worse. We need a better answer than the usual within the Beltway one of reinforcing failure with more money and redoubled effort. Hit him again harder is a great cheer at a football game, not a counterterrorism strategy. So far, I've talked about the sources of our problems. Let me turn to the methods for dealing with them. I need to get into that subject in order to collect the Nobel Prize I promised my mother I would win. Before I do, that is, talk about different approaches that might actually work, I should say a few words about what's at stake for the United States in the Middle East. In that region, the United States is now locked in death-filled dances with fanatic enemies, ungrateful client states, alienated allies, and resurgent adversaries. And no one can tell us how any of this will end. It's understandable that growing numbers of Americans want out. Some say the United States no longer has any real interest in the Middle East, so Americans should just cut our losses, cease meddling, and let God straighten out the mess we've made. In foreign affairs, interests are the measure of all things. And the Middle East is still where Africa, Asia, and Europe meet. That makes it both the mother of all strategic choke points and the geographic axis of the world's transportation routes, as the growing global dominance of Gulf Arab Airlines has been proving until we cleverly banned laptops for business travelers patronizing them. The ability to transit the Middle East is essential to U.S. global power projection. A decision to write off the region would be a decision to go out of business as a world power. Maybe we should do that, but we need to understand the consequences. That is something quite distinct from becoming more restrained and using our military power, which I and many other Americans think would be a good idea. And the Middle East is still where two-thirds of the world's oil is located. Shale has made the United States once again an oil exporter and the world's swing producer, but it hasn't altered the fact that energy prices are set on a global basis, not in the U.S. market. Middle Eastern oil remains a key determinant of long-term energy costs, and energy costs are a crucial factor in the health of the global economy. The quality of life in America depends, importantly, on prosperity beyond our borders. We cannot ignore the impact of developments in the Middle East on our national well-being. And the Middle East is still the focus of the world's most stridently self-righteous, schismatic, and pugnacious religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. What happens in and around their holy places affects the moral convictions, emotional balances, and political judgments of global communities consisting of billions of human beings. As we've seen, events in the region that involve religion can decide whether there is domestic tranquility or turbulence, not just there, but here. And the Middle East is still rife with resentments that fuel anti-American terrorism with global reach. Imperialism, Western, including Jewish colonialism, alleged American support for the undemocratic status quo or for efforts to undermine it, overt and covert attempts at regime change, other past and present humiliations, as well as memories of ancient assaults by European crusaders, provide tinder for zealotry to ignite. America's intemperate reactions and interactions with the sledding conflagrations in the Middle East continue to stoke the flames of hatred there. Arab efforts to settle scores with the West now periodically wreak havoc in Europe. They threaten to do the same in the American homeland. Blaming Islam for the Islamist terrorism is like blaming the Pope for the actions of the IRA, or Hinduism for the suicide bombings of Tamil Eelam in Sri Lanka, or Judaism for Israel's recurrent cruelties in Gaza. But as the Saudi counter-terrorist reform schools have demonstrated, Islam is a large part of the effective answer to Islamist terrorism. We need Muslim allies to counter Islamist theology and to help Muslims see it as the heresy that it is. For all these reasons, as well as others, the United States needs effective working relationships with the countries of the Middle East. The region is full of unfinished American foreign policy projects, some of which are not unimportant. Our decades-long effort to achieve acceptance for a Jewish state there has faltered, not yet definitively failed. Our military interventions have produced anarchy and an outflow of refugees from West Asia and North Africa that threatens to overturn the European Union. All this has made more enemies for our country than anything else in its 240-year history as an independent nation. Can we now just walk away from the mess we helped make and assume it won't follow us home? We have no choice but to remain engaged with the Middle East and with our partners there. I use the term partners advisedly. The term ally does not fit the security relationships in the Middle East that we have. We have no allies in the region. Our relationships there do not encompass mutual obligations. We have volunteered to protect them. They have made no such commitment to us. Their relationships with us are transactional, no longer based, if they ever were, on allegiance. So in return for support from us for their interests, the Saudis allow us to overfly their territory. For the same reason, they cooperate with us against Islamist terrorism. But as Israel has repeatedly gone out of its way to demonstrate, none of our partners in the region feels that it is under any obligation either to support or to refrain from opposing us. Think about Iran in that context. And when our partners don't back us, or when they actively undercut us, we impose no consequences. That amounts to fostering moral hazard through enablement. It's not friendship, any more than giving money to an alcoholic, knowing that he or she will use it to buy liquor, guzzle it, and then get behind the wheel of a car, is friendship. We have led our protégés in the Middle East to expect that the United States can always be counted upon to ensure that stupid or self-destructive behavior on their part will have no political or military consequences for them. We supply the ordnance they expend, even when they use it in ways that violate our laws and contradict our stated policies. We lean on our allies elsewhere to support them. We tolerate their open intervention in our politics to extract financial and military aid and to oppose rapprochement with Iran. The unconditionality of American backing for our clients in the Middle East explains their lack of concern about the adverse consequences of their actions and their lack of interest in correcting policies that are not just failing for them, but are counterproductive. Their behavior is a major cause of the instability, anarchy, and warfare in the region. And these conditions are the source of the blowback that now disturbs our domestic tranquility. It's time to recalibrate our relationships in the Middle East to take realistic account of the circumstances that three decades of policy error and failure have wrought. We need to focus on the protection of American interests rather than on support for the policies of partners who believe and act as though they owe us nothing and who have an appalling record of misjudging their own interests and the likely consequences of their actions. Maybe that's what our dealmaker-in-chief means by America first. Maybe that's what's made him decide to visit Riyadh and Jerusalem and make them his first stops on his maiden voyage abroad. Or maybe not. As someone said of Putin's Russia, we now live in a situation where there is no truth and everything is possible. It's as hard to tell whether particular U.S. policies are alive or dead as it is to diagnose Schrödinger's cat. Let me end with some questions that we might usefully address. Are we still with the Saudis in seeking the overthrow of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad? The effort to do so has cost 600,000 Syrian lives so far. Assad is not just there, but he's on a roll. There is a joint operation center in Baghdad uniting him and his Russian, Hezbollah, Iranian, and Iraqi allies in their common struggle against Daesh, the self-styled Islamic Caliphate. Daesh is said to be our main target in Syria as well as in Iraq. In practice, is it? And what do we plan to do when Turkey, now Russia's partner in Syria, makes good on its threat to do in our Syrian Kurdish allies after they take Raqqa from Daesh? Is the president about to ally us with the Saudi-sponsored Islamic Military Alliance to fight terrorism? Some or all of its 41 members will gather in Riyadh this week to get a glimpse of President Trump, which I'm sure will please him. Coordinating with them would give us the Muslim ideological dimension our efforts at counterterrorism have lacked. But the Saudis formed this pact to combat not just Salafi jihadism, but Iran. Is signing on to that cause a good way to roll back Salafi jihadism? Maybe, maybe not. Is there an interagency process in Washington that considers questions like that now? Iran will try to elect a president this Friday. Presidential posturing on the Iran nuclear accord and congressional sanctioneering appear to have strengthened the candidacy of Ibrahim Raisi, the hardline challenger to President Hassan Rouhani. Whether he wins or not, we could be about to enter a vicious feedback loop in which there is a further deterioration in relations between Americans, our Arab protégés, and Israel on the one hand, and Iran on the other. Trouble between the United States and Iran would delight Israel, which sees tensions with Iran as a useful diversion from having to deal with the international consequences of its brutality to its Palestinian captives. A common antipathy to Iran has also enabled increasingly overt Israeli intelligence cooperation with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Arabs, and justified collaborative manipulation of Congress critters to ensure that U.S. relations with Iran remain hostile. Hallelujah! Alhamdulillah. And what shall we do about Yemen, where our support Gulf Arab intervention has not only not prevented Al-Qaeda and Iran from entrenching their influence, but perhaps helped them do it? Or Bahrain, where the unrest of the Shiite majority continues to threaten stability and the Fifth Fleet's headquarters ashore? Or Somalia, where Al-Shabaab is attracting young Somali Americans into the Salafi jihadi movement? Or Afghanistan, or Nigeria, or the other places in which anti-American terrorists with global reach are now making headway? And how do we get out of Iraq without leaving the field there to Iran? Or does it matter? President Trump has called President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi a fantastic guy and said that the United States is, quote, very much behind him, unquote. But what if the Egyptian people have a different idea? And suppose, just suppose, that Benjamin Netanyahu remains more interested in bludgeoning the Palestinians into submission than he is in doing a deal with them. Then what? And finally, as our president prepares to set out for Riyadh, Jerusalem, and Rome, who other than his son-in-law, his former chief legal counsel, and his much-practiced bankruptcy lawyer, is helping him to prepare to make the deals he says he can make? The only thing we can be sure of on this particular itinerary is that Pope Francis is headed for beatification. But it reminds me of the old saying that if you look around the poker table and you can't spot the sucker is you. Thank you.
That's great, Chaz. Not exactly uplifting. After all, it's the Middle East. Okay, I'm going to start with some questions. First one, is there any useful way we can work with the Russians and with Putin in the Middle East?
I think we need to begin by studying what Mr. Putin has done with the very minimal investment of military force in Syria. It's almost a textbook example of how to use a military to achieve political objectives. With that minor investment of 5,000 troops and some air assets associated with them, he has done the following. He took a question which was multifaceted and reduced it to a binary issue. Are you in favor of a secular dictatorship or ruled by Muslim fanatics? Now you have to choose one or the other. He reinvigorated the Syrian armed forces, which are again on the offensive. He established, ultimately, an entente, a word we need to remember because we've lost the vocabulary of diplomacy. It means a limited partnership for a limited purpose. He's established an entente with Turkey. He's working with Iran and has strengthened his relations with it. He has shown the world that Russian weapons, which are all for sale, work and are cheap. It's a good show-off for that. He's put his hand on the spigot that controls the flow of refugees to Western Europe, reminding Europe that Russia has to be dealt with, that it's a player. And finally, he has established Russia as the primary player, replacing us in the Middle East. Not bad for a limited investment of force. Could we work with him? Yes. If we accept the reality that Bashar al-Assad is not going anywhere in the short term, he will remain in power in Damascus, and he is therefore not anything other than part of the solution. And trying to exclude him as the opposition that we have been supporting, and we bear a large responsibility for 11.5 million displaced Syrians, half the population, plus the 600,000 dead, we need to accept that as odious as he may be, as he is a reality that has to be dealt with. If we do that, then the final thing that Mr. Putin has actually accomplished, which is to force a serious peace process being conducted entirely under Russian and Turkish sponsorship with Iran in Almaty and other places in Central Asia, in our absence, Trump administration, to their credit, have now decided to observe. This replaces the propaganda pieces, the Geneva meetings, in which the players who have to make peace were absent. You cannot make peace if you do not get the buy-in of everybody who can undo it. And Mr. Putin understands that we need to understand it too. So yes, we could work with the Russians. The impediment to that probably is a lack of imagination, the hysteria about Russia in our body politic, some of which is justified, no doubt, but which is way in excess, and the inhibitions that this places on the Trump administration. I would say that we also could work with the Russians, I think, to resolve the Ukraine issue, but that's a separate region.
Okay, how about this one? What would a recalibration of our relationship with Israel look like?
I think, first of all, that's not going to happen because the entrenched viewpoint is so strong. I read this morning that Sheldon Adelson, who was a sponsor of Mr. Trump's successful election, is furious and demanding an immediate move of the embassy to Jerusalem, which would inflame the region, which Mr. Trump appears to have discovered belatedly. So it's not going to happen. If it were to happen, what would be a sensible approach? It would be to phase out enablement. Why is it that the United States gives $3.8 billion annually to a state that is the military superpower in the Middle East and is wealthier than the state of Maine? Charity might begin at home. Why is it? It's not just the $3.8 billion, by the way. It's all sorts of tax loopholes and breaks and access to the defense budget on the same basis as American companies. And it may be as much as a $20 billion annual subsidy for the state of Israel and its settlement activity, which we all believed was contrary to its interest in achieving acceptance in the region and peace with the other people who are there, namely the Palestinians. A, it's not going to happen. B, it's not hard to figure out what ought to be done. And that is put Israel in a position where it actually has to consider the consequences of what it does, rather than assume the United States will always have its back. The basic premise of U.S.-Israeli relations is what psychiatrists would call codependency.
What are your views on the Arab Spring movement and its possible effect on restructuring of the Middle East?
I never liked the term Arab Spring because it evoked memories of the Prague Spring. And therefore, it caused people to imagine that there was some eruption of desire for Western-style democracy in the Arab world. But I don't think that's what it was. These were Arab uprisings against the status quo. The parts of the status quo to which people objected included the protection of dictators by foreign powers. The fact that Hosni Mubarak was propped up by the United States in the view of Egyptians, maybe wrong, but anyway, that was their view. Or Zain al-Ali in Tunisia was propped up by the French, and that the pattern of colonial intrusion in the region that began in 1798, July 1, when Napoleon invaded Egypt, had not been broken. Countries were nominally independent, but still, in fact, dependent. And furthermore, the systems of government that had been installed were not authentic, indigenous, or legitimate. And so I think what we saw with the Arab uprisings was very similar to what we saw in the Islamic Revolution in Iran. That is, the joining of Islamic tradition with native traditions to eject foreign influence and strike out on their own. It wasn't about installing parliamentary democracy. And if you had any doubt about that, the series of coups and changes that occurred everywhere but Tunisia should have dissuaded you. The Arab uprisings did transform the Middle East. Among other things, in addition to throwing out Zain al-Ali, Hosni Mubarak, Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen, they misled both us and the Saudis and Qataris and Emiratis and the Israelis and the Turks, just about everybody, and Bashar al-Assad about what the significance of unrest in southwestern Syria was in late March 2011. We thought, aha, you know, with a little push, Mubarak went. With a little push, Ali Abdullah Saleh went. With a little push, we can get rid of Bashar al-Assad. Why? Nobody can explain why that's to our interest. But anyway, the argument is Arabs want liberal democracy, and if you got rid of Assad, that would automatically arise. Well, it turned out that, in fact, much as Assad may have been disliked by most Syrians, they feared him less than they feared the alternatives to him. And particular groups in Syrian society, the large Christian community, the Druze, much of the secular Sunni population feared Daesh Islamism much more than they detested Assad. So we gave a little push, and he pushed back. Now, his mistake was he looked at this unrest and the foreign involvement in it and saw, if I don't nip this in the bud, I'm going to go the way of Mubarak. And he overreacted. But it is actually not true that this was nonviolent protest. It was violent on both sides from the very beginning. But that's another problem, you know, is nothing is true, everything is possible, and nobody can tell you what's true anymore. We have a president who unbalances perceptions of reality.
Here is one about something that nobody mentions much anymore, and maybe with reason, the UN. Would the beefing up of funds give the UN more power and incentives to fix something?
Well, of course, we're trying to do the opposite, cut the UN. I think that's a mistake. But the UN really operates on three levels, one of which is extremely effective, and that is the specialized agencies of the United Nations, the ones that deal with development, with, you know, meteorology, with standards, with all sorts of things, are very effective and they're irreplaceable. Second element of the UN is the UN Charter, which is a codification of international law, which we spent much of the 20th century trying to support and establish. In more recent years, we have trashed it. There is no deference whatsoever paid to international law. Look at Syria. We are boasting about, if it doesn't work, we're apologizing for the failure of overt intervention in another state's internal affairs that kills lots of people. UN passed a resolution for humanitarian intervention in Libya. That became a regime change enabler. We invaded Iraq with the opposition of two-thirds of the world's nations. And then we created what was called the Coalition of the Billing, who were happy to sign up for a bit of money in return for providing symbolic companionship on the battlefields of Iraq. And the third area where the UN operates, which may be the most important and the least effective at the moment, is it was effective during the Gulf War of 1991. That is, the UN Security Council was able to achieve a consensus among the world's major powers that the post-Cold War era should not begin by accepting that a large country could swallow up a smaller neighbor by force, and that the rules had to be obeyed, and that the new era, the new world order, would not be one that was lawless. Well, that was then, this is now. But the UN Security Council is defective structurally. It consists of the victors of World War II. Britain and France have a greater weight in it than Japan. Germany is not represented, even though it is the center of European politics. India is not in it. And therefore, it's an imperfect prism. It does not reflect the spectrum or constellation of global power. And that makes it inherently problematic, even if the United States had not decided that we would pay no attention to it, other than for rhetorical purposes. So I think the UN is very important, and I think we could work with it. It has been useful to us in the past. We created it, basically. It was FDR's idea. And I think we ought to try to use it instead of trashing it, but we seem to be on the road to trashing it.
Okay, back to Russia for a moment. How does investigating the role of Russia in our election and our affairs relate to your views about the Middle East?
I think we need an investigation. We need to clear the air. We need to determine what is the truth here. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Russians had not invested a lot in influencing our election. That would hardly be unique. That's the first thing the CIA did when it was formed, and influencing the elections in France and Italy along the way, you know, overthrowing the elected democratic government of Mossadegh in Iran and doing the same other places, Salvador Allende, and, you know, that so forth and so on. Anyway, so the Russians, if they did that, are not unique. And so, in a way, we're just finding out how other people have felt for quite a long time, being on the receiving end. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't investigate this, get this clear, sit down and talk to the Russians and try to reduce the possibility of future interference and fix our electoral politics, which produced results that nobody really liked in the last several elections, not just this one. We have a broken system, and we need to fix it. There are two ways to do that. One, you could actually return to the Constitution, which starts with a separation of powers, which says that the Congress is responsible for authorizing wars of choice. Well, we're fighting 9 wars at the moment, all of them presidentially ordained, none of them endorsed by Congress. I wish President Trump would have, in the inaugural address, said something like this: I will not start a war except upon the constitutional approval of such a war by Congress. And I intend to submit all of the wars that my predecessors began without that constitutional authority for endorsement by the Congress. And if there is no endorsement, I will take that as an instruction to end them on the best terms I can obtain. We'd be better off if that had happened.
It's a great idea. Ain't going to happen. Let me change the subject for a moment, because it's an interesting question, even though this is not the topic, but it's an area in which you're an expert. Please comment on the influence or the lack of influence the Chinese have over the North Koreans.
China fought a bloody war, which it did not start. Zhou Enlai once said in my presence that he heard about the opening of the Korean War on the Voice of America. It was Stalin who empowered Kim Il-sung to go south on June 25, 1950, and left the Chinese holding the bag. When they came in the fall, it was to ensure that no hostile force, namely MacArthur, who had a big mouth as well as a well-justified reputation as a brilliant strategist, they didn't want a hostile force on their border. And they sacrificed over 1 million men to establish a cordon sanitaire, a neutral buffer zone, which would keep American forces or Japanese or other forces at bay. Once they did that, achieved that, basically forcing us back to the 38th parallel, they stopped. By 1959, they'd withdrawn all their forces in Korea, so they haven't been there for decades. No love lost between China and North Korea. The Chinese consider North Korea to be even worse than their own worst governments in the past. They have great respect for the ability of the Korean people to endure hardship, and I'll come back to that. But they have very little influence in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-un has not visited Beijing. He has rejected the Chinese envoys who've been sent there. What they do have is economic leverage. Most of North Korea's trade is through China or with China. A lot of it is illegal smuggling, but they can moderate that. Now we come to a philosophical difference. The United States, for reasons that empiricists do not understand, believes that sanctions can alter the fundamental behavior of other governments. There is not a single instance of success in this. The only time that sanctions work is as an adjunct to a bargaining process. And then they are better as threats than they are as actual measures. Because once you put them in place, you create vested interests in their continuation. You distort trade and you give people an incentive to work around them. And you inflame passion on the other side. And as we have seen with Cuba, you enable the target of those sanctions to claim that everything that's going wrong is the fault of the sanctions and hostility on the part of the United States or the international community or whoever it is. So the Chinese, having been subjected to 23 years of sanctions themselves by us, which didn't work, just don't think that is a productive approach unless it's tied to a negotiation. So their question to us for the last 20 years has been, okay, sanctions, but what's your offer? What are you trying to get North Korea specifically to agree to? And by the way, the reason they're building nuclear weapons is because they believe you want regime change in Pyongyang, and they need a deterrent to that. And the lesson of the Middle East, ask the ghost of Colonel Gaddafi, is if you do a deal with the United States and get rid of your weapons of mass destruction, you're likely to end up dead. Hillary Clinton said of Gaddafi, "We came, we saw, he died." One of the most cynical and, I think, contemptible statements that any leader in the United States has ever made about another human being. But the impact on Kim Jong-un is obvious. So the question is, with the Chinese, two questions. What's our bargaining strategy? Do we have one? Or do we just imagine that unrelenting pressure somehow, despite 60 years of it having produced nothing, will somehow change North Korea for the better? And the second question is, are you going to be in Korea when North Korea collapses? Mm-hmm. Are you going to be on our border? Are you going to put your radars there and your missiles and your ships and your Marines? And what assurance do you give us that you're not going to exploit the situation in Korea to get us? Well, it's a valid question, and it deserves an answer, and it hasn't had one. So the Middle East does bear on this because of the unfortunate that we set with Iraq, with Gaddafi. International law is no protection against the United States. Agreements with the United States are no protection against American intervention. And this is a good example of why, before you do those things, you should ask, and then what? And how will people see this?
What is your view about what will get the Palestinians to come to the bargaining table in good faith? Specifically, do the Palestinians understand their demand for the right of return?
Well, on that point, yes, of course they understand that. The issue is not getting the Palestinians to the bargaining table. The issue is that there's this fellow Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas, who is the capo in a concentration camp known as Palestine. Palestinians have no bargaining power, none. So the prisoners are bargaining with their jailers, and there's no outside force supporting them. And there is an outside force supporting their jailers. That's us. So this nonsense about the Palestinians won't come to the bargaining table, by the way, it's very similar to the nonsense about Iran not coming to the bargaining table. We were the ones who refused to go to the bargaining table. And in the end, they did come to the bargaining table, and we got a deal that was much worse than the one they had offered the Brazilians and Turks, who negotiated on our behalf as third parties 10 years previously. Palestinians have everything to gain by reaching an agreement that gives them independence, that allows them self-determination, as they were promised, both in the partition plan in 1947, the UN, and in the Camp David Accords. There's no Palestinian effort underway to throw Israelis into the sea. There is an Israeli effort underway to throw Palestinians out of Palestine. So let's be clear about what the balance of power is there and who's got an incentive to change posture. Why should Israel change posture? Everything's going its way. It's got, by its own self-description, the most pro-Israel government in the United States ever. And the fact that it may be losing support internationally is offset by that. So Why should Israelis change? They won't.
How about Yemen? How is the Yemen best resolved? Is there anything the United States can do? Is Saudi Arabia making a mess of it? What's going to happen?
I think the Saudis are making a mess of it, and it's just the Israeli interventions in Gaza and Lebanon, which are basically exercises of military power for the purpose of terrorizing the population, not for any achievable, feasible political result. You know, Israel, in the very cynical phrase that Israelis use, they have to go out and, quote, mow the grass periodically. In other words, chop down anybody in the region who might rise to the point of being able to challenge them. And the Saudis are doing the same in Yemen, and equally without an end game in sight. I think it's very difficult. Their rationale is that they want to restore the ousted government of al-Hadi. I think it's very hard to install a government from the air or even with mercenaries. And so far, it's been unsuccessful. In Yemen, in the past, the Saudis managed with what we used to call realpolitik, reals being the currency in Saudi Arabia. And realpolitik involved bribing everybody and keeping them off balance. And it was practiced great sophistication by the late Prince Sultan bin Abdulaziz. And interestingly, the Houthis used to be on the Saudi payroll. They had a religious revelation, which coincided with the Saudis cutting them off. Anyway, I don't think the thesis that realpolitik is better than armed intervention, bombing, and strafing has been disproved. And I think the Saudis need to find an end state and an end game and a war termination strategy, and we ought to be helping them to do that. And whether backing them with more arms sales is the way to do that or not depends on what we are telling them, and nobody knows. Maybe Mr. Trump, when he's in Riyadh, will counsel mm-hmm. them correctly to find a way to declare victory and leave.
Yes, certainly. Okay, one final one, since you mentioned President Trump. Who's advising Secretary Tillerson, since there are no senior staff apparently available to do so?
That's an interesting question. There are no senior staff. There's no Deputy Secretary of State yet. I think he's nominated but not approved. There's nobody else in a position of authority. And I think Secretary Tillerson has come up with an innovative way of trimming a bloated organization by not naming anybody to it. And, and the good thing about that is if you don't name people to positions, then you can abolish the positions and nobody will squeal. So, or not many. And there are 68 special envoys, ambassadors at large and other sinecures intended to appease domestic interest groups but accomplish nothing whatsoever abroad, for the most part. If an organization requires bridge positions like that, those of you who have run companies, I'm sure would agree with me, then the organization is malorganized. He has a lot of experience running large bureaucracies, and I think, as I say, he's got an innovative way of trimming the Department of State back to fighting shape. But in the meantime, nobody's advising him. He's a smart guy. He's learning. I wonder why we have a system where we expect incompetent people to learn to become competent after they take the job. There is a great deal to be said for parliamentary systems in which there are shadow cabinets, and the people who come in as minister have been practicing for the job and exercising their debating skills on the issues for years before they actually come into power. That, of course, if we won't go back to the Constitution, which I agree with you is unlikely, adopting a parliamentary system would be a good fix. And that could be done at the state level. And I suppose that this is the state of Maine. Everybody is ecstatic about the status of government in your state. I'm from Rhode Island, and you know, I've always thought we had a war with Massachusetts in the 17th century. We lost half of Bristol County to Massachusetts, which is why there's a Massachusetts Bristol County as well as a Rhode Island one. And I've always felt so sorry for the people in Massachusetts having been deprived of the benefits of honest, efficient government. Something to be said for the mafia running things.
Many thanks. That was great.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, the program is available on our website, mainepublic.org. where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer. For Speaking in Maine on Maine Public, I'm Gordon Fellas.